Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley from the world's greatest race course as the sun begins to set. We are high above the Yard of Bricks along the main straightaway. Thanks for joining us tonight. My name is Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is here, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor with us, and you can call in. We have either wide open phone lines or the call screener thingamajiggy is not working at this point. So 317-239-1070 is our telephone number if you have a question for Donald tonight. We also have a special guest sitting in who will ask his question coming up in a little bit later on. William Pran is here with us, a contributor to the Carb Night Burger Bash, which is coming up in a week and a half, the Friday before the 500. All right, now we're set. We have full phone lines, and we are ready to go, and we start with Peter in Sacramento, up first with Donald Davidson tonight.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Peter. Is this the first time I call for you?
I called last year, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. I'd like you to profile a driver I think would have won the 500 had he got to run a full career, and that is Swede Savage.
Yeah, definitely. Swede Savage was very highly touted, and there was a lot of pressure on him. Actually, he was entered in 1971 and didn't get to run. He was a Dan Gurney protege, and I always thought that he looked like Dan in a lot of ways, and it was almost like this was Dan's younger brother. So certainly in appearance, they looked a lot alike, I thought. Anyway, Swede was entered to be Bobby Unser's teammate in 1971, and he was injured in the Questor Grand Prix, which was a road race at the Ontario Motor Speedway using the road course, and it was an invitational event with Formula One cars and drivers and Formula 5000 cars, and Swede had an accident and got a concussion, and so he was out for I think the entire year. Anyway, to back up, he had already won a championship race. He'd actually won the finale at Phoenix late in the race. There was a problem with Al Unser, and then Roger McCluskey ran out of fuel, I think, on the last lap, and Swede was able to get around him and win. And I remember he'd been very strong the year before that on road courses at Brainerd, Minnesota, and then also at Kent, Washington. And then I'm trying to think about that at Raceway Park in 70. I think he might have been third. I could be wrong on that. But anyway, he did win Phoenix, and then he's entered for the 500 for the first time, and then that doesn't happen, or he doesn't get to run because of that injury. So 1972 was the first time that he ran. And it was for Michelin Petroleum, which was transitioning into the Patrick Racing team. And Swede qualified for his first 500 with probably the least attractive paint job I think there's ever been. It was brown with yellow numbers, not attractive. And he had one of the Antares cars, which was even worse. Car at all, but it had that same paint job. And then what he ran, I think, was a Brabham. Anyway, he only lasted 3, 4, 5 laps because he was out in 32nd place. I don't remember much about the rest of that year. I don't think it was terribly memorable. But anyway, Pat Patrick had now come in as the sponsor of the Michelin Petroleum team, and then had basically taken it over, and there was a major reorganization for 1973, and that's when George Bignotti came on board, and they had new Eagles, and Swede Savage was always a part of that team, and then the rest of it we don't need to go into now. There was some very interesting behind the scenes maneuvering on who was going to drive the other car. Anyway, Swede was under a lot of pressure. There was an article in, was it True Magazine or something? It was not a racing publication, and it it was trying to figure out who was the 100 greatest drivers or the 10 greatest drivers. It was some kind of a poll, and Swede was on there. I don't quite have that right, but anyway, there was some kind of a poll where he was named, and some people thought that that was a little bit premature. I don't want to mention any names, but there was a guy from Albuquerque that won it three times that was quite vocal about that. And I think Swede sort of felt like he maybe had to prove a point. Anyway, he was always a very intense guy. I'd met him. I didn't really know him very well. I've got a letter from him buried somewhere. And it was very rare that you saw him laugh. He was just always very, very intense. So anyway, he went out. And in 73, the weather was terrible, and the speeds were faster than they'd ever been. And Swede temporarily had the pole, and then it eventually ended up that he was on the inside of the second row, and Johnny Rutherford almost did a 200 in winning the pole. He had a lap at 199.071, and I don't remember what Swede was probably like in the 197 range. But he was temporarily on the pole, and I mean, it was scary fast. So anyway, in the race, he was effectively fourth for much of the way, but he did lead, and that was during pit stop shuffles. And I don't remember how many laps he led now. It wasn't very many, but he did actually lead some laps. I think it was like maybe five. And then about 70-something laps. Boy, I'm going to have to hit the books on these things. There was this horrendous accident. He had just made a pit stop, and they still had 75-gallon onboard fuel was allowable. And so he had just made the stop, went out, and I'm not sure if he ever completed a lap after the stop, or maybe he did one. And then all of a sudden, there was this horrendous accident coming out of turn four. And not to be overly graphic about it, because I try to steer away from accidents, but I remember the fire just lit up the place, and it was dark. I mean, it was going to rain. It had been rain threatening all day, and in fact, the race would end up being stopped short because of rain, but it was stopped because of the accident. But anyway, when that thing hit, I remember looking up from the master control tower. And I was in there with Sid Collins and Fred Agabasian, and the flames were just, they were yellow. Mm. They weren't red, they were yellow. And so anyway, I could tell you a lot more about that. The race was stopped, and no word was coming back, and Sid actually asked me. He said, look, we can't get any word from up at the North End. The turn reporters aren't giving us very much. And so why don't you go down there and see what you can find out? So I'm a reporter going North End. And I remember that it was an STP sponsored car, the Dayglow Red. And there were specks of that fluorescent paint all over the place. It was just as if somebody had decorated it for a party, which it was anything but. But I just remember looking, and there was just these thousands and thousands of fluorescent red specks all over the track. So anyway, it took a while to clean the thing up, and Swede, of course, was injured severely. The car, you know, it was one of those things. Those 73 Eagles. The engine was actually, what did they call it, a stressed member? I mean, so in other words, there was no frame. You had the tub and the front wheels and the suspension, and then the engine actually was bolted on to the behind the where the driver sat, so anyway, whenever there was a bad accident, it happened several times. The cockpit where the driver went one direction, and the engine and the rear wheels would go in the other. So anyway, Swede received traumatic injuries, and he survived 33 days, but he was on a machine. And I know that the people went to see him, and And I won't go into too much more with that. But anyway, finally, after 33 days, he passed away. And it was right around Pocono time. But just to go back a little bit, he was a very intense guy. And apparently the car was pushing before the accident. Some of the drivers said that, you know, his arms were crossed because it had a severe push. But he was a driven personality that just had to win. And he'd been a motorcycle racer, and there's a little bit of trivia there. The answer is going to be obvious because I pretty much gave it away, but I used it in a trivia contest for a while, that in 1972 and 1973, there were two drivers in the Indianapolis 500 who had also ridden previously in the Daytona 200 motorcycle race. And Joe Leonard was one. Who was the other? And the answer was Swede Savage, which I think was 1966. I don't remember where he finished, but anyway, he did compete in that event. And so anyway, that's the daughter, Angela, came back here, what, 3 years ago, I think it was? And
yeah, I think so.
It was... or it might have been 2013, because it might have been the anniversary. Well, it might have been the 40th anniversary. And her mother never did come back, and, you know, who would want to? But anyway, the daughter felt that she needed to, you know, just come back and meet people and learn about her dad. So that's probably more than you wanted to hear. And, I would rather do happy... you know, skipping through the fields, throwing daisies around the place with some of the answers. But anyway, I think Swede definitely was, as I say, I'll just wind up by saying he was a very intense guy. It was hard to get him to laugh, but it was really neat when he did. And I think that had it not been for the accident, he probably would have won a lot of races and maybe the 500. I don't know.
Thank you, Peter. More of your questions for Donald are coming on the Talk of Gasoline Alley from IMS on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Donald Davidson, I'm Kevin Lee. And Mark is next in Speedway with Donald. Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good,
got a question,
good.
Donald. Would you profile the car owner, Pat Patrick, and his connection with Chip Ganassi? No, hang up and listen.
Okay, and you just mentioned Pat Patrick a moment ago.
Yeah, I did. The connection with Pat Patrick is that Ganassi... No, wait a minute.
They partnered together first.
They were. That's going to be a little... Yeah, that's... I'd have to remember how that came around. Anyway, the first time I was aware of Pat Patrick was as a sponsor for the Michener team that we were talking about earlier. And I think in 1968 is the first time that I remember him being around and that the Patrick logo started to appear on the Michener Petroleum cars. And then later in 68 and certainly by 1969, they became... the Patrick Petroleum Specials, and then I think it was, as I said earlier with the Swede Savage answer, in 72 and prior to 73 is when it then became the Patrick Racing Team, and then they won that tragic race, in which Swede Savage lost his life, Gordon Johncock was declared the winner of the rain-shortened race. And lots of stories about that, race night and so on and so forth. But anyway, there were actually three cars in 73, and Graham McRae drove the other one and won the Rookie of the Year award. There's a few teams that have had the winner and the Rookie of the Year in the same race with different drivers. But Patrick Had Sinmast for a sponsor. I mean, I could do the thing year by year, but in order to try and, I mean, this could be a very long answer, but to try and shorten them up a little bit, they started to construct their own cars, Wildcats, and they were built. I don't know if all of them were built, but when they won in 1982 with Gordon Jarcock winning for him again, the Wildcats that won the race in 1952 and the team car that Mario drove, those cars were built at the Patrick Racing Team's shop, which was up behind Lafayette Square. And now, for a while, none of the cars were being built in the United States. And here was a winning car that was built, three miles up the road. But anyway, the connection with Ian Patrick, I'd have to think about, because Patrick actually was out of it for a while. I got to remember how this came about, because he was out of it and then came back in as sort of like the Firestone Tire return development team, if that makes any sense. So Firestone left at the end of the 74 season, and then when they came back in 1995 with Scott Pruett, and this, of course, was a new Firestone now. The logo was the same, but it was now Japanese-owned. And then...
Ganassi, when he was getting into car ownership, yeah, I think bought an interest into Pat Patrick's team in the late 80s.
Yes, because they won in 89. Patrick won in 89 with Emerson Fittipaldi, and was still... this gets very confusing, because if you look at the Emerson Fittipaldi paint jobs in 1989 and 1990, they're identical with the marble livery, except it was Patrick in 89 and then Penske in 90. And people get that wrong both ways. But anyway, Ganassi, I guess, was a partner. And then in 1990, Ganassi was the sole owner, and he had Eddie Cheever.
Yep.
And then in...
and then you're right, Pat Patrick got back into it again.
Yeah.
And Allinger Jr., who was just here, I know, drove for him in the IRL. So he continued into the 2000s.
But he had the Alfa Romeo deal in...
That's right.
In 90 and 91. So actually, that's what I said. I needed to think about that a bit. In 91, with... Danny Sullivan and Roberto Guerrero with the Alfa Romeo team, and in 90 with Al Unser and Roberto Guerrero, that was Patrick Racing Team. So, again, I'm not very good on the recent years. Ask me about the 40s and 50s and the early 60s. As far as the relationship between the two, I really don't know anything about that.
All right, thank you for the question. Jonathan in Chicago is next with Donald Davidson. Hi, Jonathan.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Jonathan.
With it being the 100th anniversary of the U.S. getting involved in the Great War, I was wondering if maybe you could talk about the lead-up to the cancellation of the 1917 race, and also what went on at the track during the Great War. And were there any drivers besides Eddie Rickenbacker who served on the Western Front?
Yes, there's several ways to answer that. First of all, there were rumors for quite some time or questions, because I went through and read the newspaper microfilm, and there was questions for some time as to whether there would America be drawn into the war, because by 1915. Number of drivers, foreign drivers, and I don't mean residents, foreign people living in the United States, but visiting drivers did not return in 1915. And René Thomas, who was the 14 winner, and Jules Gou, who was the 13 winner that came back in 14, and Georges Boileau of the Peugeot team, who was Gou's teammate, was the fastest qualifier, and Albert Guillot, and maybe a couple of others, they weren't here in 1915 because they were all now involved in the war. And so Boileau and Gou at least, and maybe Guillaume, they were chauffeurs for the generals right at the front. And I don't remember. Boileau was an aviator. In fact, he went down in aerial combat. And in fact, that's something that I've used from time to time to illustrate how things were just a little bit different then. Boileau still held the track record at Indianapolis 2 years, almost 2 years later to the day, when he was shot down over Verdun, or however that's pronounced. And so we don't have anybody doing that anymore at the moment. But so anyway, the 15 and 16 both, there was discussion, rumors, you know, will there be a race? Will there be a race? Well, of course, there was in 15 and 16. And then as far as what Fisher was going to do, there was a dispute with the local hoteliers over price. Now, this is 100 years ago, and Fisher was complaining to the hotel owners downtown that his friends coming in from out of town were getting gouged because all the hotels were jacking the rates up. And so he threatened to not hold the race, but have it take place at a brand new board track down in Cincinnati. And it was finally around maybe December when they got that settled, and so the word came on. In fact, it might even have been a little bit later than that, because I know that when they finally came back and said, all right, the 500-mile race is on for 1917, it was only like a couple of weeks before then they canceled, because now the United States had got so deeply involved in the war that that they suspended and didn't have it in 17 and 18. And then the answer is what happened to the track? Well, it became an aviation depot. I think there were three battalions that were stationed here. And for a while, I thought that they bivouacked in the infield. Well, it turns out that there were barracks just south of here. So if you go down Main Street to approximately where Dallara is right now, and just south of that, that's where the barracks were.
Wow.
And but they worked out of the infield, and it was a refueling depot. There was a run that went from Dayton, which I think might have, I don't know if that's too early for Wright Field. It was too early for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, that. But I think it was Wright Field by that time. And then also there was a McCook's Field in Dayton, so I'm a little hazy on this for the moment. But anyway, there was a run that went from Dayton to Urbana, Illinois, and the planes couldn't, they didn't have the capacity to do that nonstop. So they would actually stop in the infield at the Indianapolis Speedway to refuel. And there were several experimental aircraft out of here. I mean, this is, have I got a couple more minutes for this segment? Okay.
We were supposed to break 2 minutes ago, but
down,
go ahead.
All right. Well, down, maybe we should make it a two-parter, but down on Main Street, there used to be Bouchard's trailers. Remember, I don't know if you're probably too young to remember those the ads that would run the drive-in movies. But anyway, Bouchard trailers were all over the place. But his office was down on Main Street, and somebody said, "You got to go talk to Mr. Bouchard because he's lived in this area his whole life." So I went down to talk to him, and he told me, he said, "I remember when the Speedway Lumber Company, which was owner of 10th and Main, where the hospital is now, or where the healthcare place is, that used to be the Speedway Lumber Company," and he said they would build planes down there. And then an engine from Allison Engineering would be installed, and then they would tow the plane with a horse-drawn cart, towing it down Main Street, which was dirt, with the plane on the back of the flatbed, and then tow it over here, and then they would take off. They had a monorail on the infield. Hmm. There was a second part to that question. I don't remember what it was now. We've come out. We're in the middle of World War One, and
I thought that was it. Is what was it used
for? Okay,
yeah.
It could be. Well, maybe we should take a break, and then I'll think about if there was a, if there was another part. It seemed to me there was about a 3 or 4 part to that.
All right, stay with us. More to come. Questions for Donald and the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 1070 The Fan. Talk Gasoline Alley continues from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Donald came up with something else he wants to mention about Sweet Savage, and I see David also has a follow-up from our previous conversation, so maybe they will be the same. So we'll start with David, and then Donald will add his thought.
All right, sure.
Go ahead, David.
Hey, Donald, how are you?
Fine. David Coleman?
Yes, sir, it is. Thank you very much for allowing me to come on. Two quick things. Donald, you had made reference of Sweet Savage's crash at the Quest Grand Prix in 1971,
yes.
And even though he was out a few months, but he also competed in the 1971 California 500. And the reason why I know is because I was listening to that race, and he was running in the top 10 near the end of the race, and the race announcers from the booth, that they had a booth back then, were talking about how well he was doing. And no sooner than they got the words out of their mouth, they went to turn three, and they did have track announcers at the California 500 at that time. And the announcer said that Savage had went into a spin. He did make contact, but he did go into a spin. And I just wanted to mention that. And then one other thing quickly, I remember that True magazine because I was a young guy and I used to read it, and it was like a thin magazine, like about 80 pages.
Yeah.
And not only did they reference the top 10 drivers, it seemed like it might have been more than the top 10.
Yeah.
But not only did they reference the top 10 drivers in the United States, they also referenced the top 10 drivers in the world. But it seemed like it was more like maybe the top 20. But you could be right, Donald. It might have been the top 10. And one other thing is that I remember there was a article in there about Sweet Savage and Dan Gurney, because they were at a racetrack and they were eating some fried chicken together during, it was like a break in the race or a break in the action. And there was a good picture of them both at the racetrack. They were eating fried chicken. They were engaged in a conversation. And that's all I want to say. So I really appreciate you giving me this privilege. You're doing a great job.
All right,
job.
David. Well, thank you. I need to find that article. I think I got it somewhere. Comments was just a little bit more of a personal nature on Swede. His name was David Earl Savage, and Swede was a nickname he'd got since he was when he was quite young, because he had very, very fair hair and he looked Swedish. So anyway, at some point he had gone down to still motorcycle racing, but he ended up at Holman and Moody doing very menial tasks because he was just trying to get his foot in the door. And a PR guy from Ford named Monty Roberts happened to be down to visit Holman and Moody. And here was this blonde kid over in the corner sweeping the floor. And so he said to one of them, who's that? And they said, oh, that's a kid Dan Gurney sent down here. And he wants to be a race driver. He said, really? It was a good looking kid. What's his name? And they said, Swede Savage. And he said, you're making that up. He said, no, that's his name. And Monty, the wheel started turning. And he said, Swede Savage? Oh, I think we can do something with this. And so he got, I guess he got his foot in the door with Ford somehow that way. Anyway, that's just my follow-up.
Okay, and the World War One question, the other part that you did talk about a little bit was drivers that served on the Western fronts.
Oh, that's okay. Yes, all right then. Yes, because he mentioned Rickenbacker.
Mm-hmm.
That I knew there was something else. Okay, well, I mentioned the foreign guys. Well, Rickenbacker went over there. And he did not have sufficient education to be eligible for flight school or whatever it was at the time with the, I think it might have been the Army Air Corps by that time. Anyway, so Rickenbacker being Rickenbacker found his way in and came back as the World War One flying ace. Another driver that drove before and after the race, because Rickenbacker didn't race after, he only ran before World War One. A driver that ran before and after was Art Klein from Cleveland, Lieutenant Arthur Klein. And then also there was Herschel McKee, who drove relief in 1926 and was a riding mechanic several times. And at the moment, those are the only ones that I can think of that were actually pilots in World War One. There might have been some others that I think of at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Let's get back to it. And Mike in Vernon Hills is up next. Hi, Mike. You're on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Hi. Good, thank you.
Good. About a week ago, I had the pleasure of seeing the Ford exhibit at the museum, and I was really blown away by not only the cars but the memorabilia on display. And, Donald, I noticed you were in the brochure were given one of the credits, so thanks to you and the team for a great job at the on that exhibit.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
Yeah, so one of my favorite cars there was the 65 Lotus that won the poll. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that history of that car and the competition for the poll in 1965.
I'll have to think about where that one came from. It was a Team Lotus car the year before. And golly, that's... let me think about that. Was that wasn't Clark's pole car because Parnelli drove that to second. So forget the lineage of that. It would have run in 64. But anyway, as far as the run for the pole, I'll do this, and then while I'm talking, I'll try and think at the same time. I remember that Mario Andretti was one of the first to go out, and I know that he was temporarily on the pole and then ended up in starting fourth, so that was rather similar to the Sweet Savage situation. And but anyway, let's see what happened after Mario went out. Jim Clark went out. Because I was trying to think, Dan Gurney ended up on the outside of the front row, but he did not have the temporary pole. I think Mario held it until Jim Clark went out, and then Mario had broken 1 and 4 lap track records. Clark broke his to sit on the temporary pole, and then Foyt went out, and I think he was he might have been the very next one out after Clark, or maybe Gurney went between the two of them. And so temporarily would have been in the middle of the front row if that was so. And then, but I know that there wasn't very much time between Clark's run and then Foyt's run. And then Foyt, just the place came unglued because then Foyt broke the 1 and 4 lap track records of Clark to sit on the pole. And I remember when he was interviewed by probably Jim Phillippe, I think did most of the post-qualification interviews in those days. And Foyt said, I just wanted to bring the record back to the United States. And I remember the accent on the United States part. And the crowd went nuts, and a lot of people cheered, and a lot of people, not everybody cheered, because Clark was very, very popular. And Foyt was what I suppose a polarizing character would be in those days. Because I remember that a lot of races, like the Hoosier 100 specifically, I remember, when Foyt would be introduced at driver intro, he would get a huge cheers and huge boos all at the same time. But anyway, as far as where that, which one of those, what the Foyt pole car had been in 64, it must have been a Dan Gurney car or one of the ones that they had used because I remember that Parnelli Jones, because Clark was not there was a conflict with the Milwaukee 200 in August in 64. Was it the German Grand Prix, I think? And then so anyway, Parnelli Jones drove for Lotus. The Lotus drivers at Milwaukee were Parnelli Jones and Foyt. And I don't think that – and Foyt was out after like one or two laps with a transmission problem. I don't think that's the car that he sat on the pole with. But Parnelli won at Milwaukee. And then when they went to Trenton, Clark ran the same car that Parnelli had driven. And then Parnelli won Trenton with a different Lotus. It looks like it's the same one. And it could have been one of those that Foyt had at his disposal for 1965 and sat on the pole. And then as far as in the race, Foyt led 10 laps. Oh, I remember this. He started on the pole. He led the first lap. And now, wait a minute. Did he lead the first lap? No, Clark led the first lap. Clark led the first lap. Foyt led the second lap, and then Clark led the third lap, and it looked like it was a great battle that ensued there. And then a little bit later, when Clark made his first stop, Foyt stayed out and led 9 laps, and then when he came in, then Clark went back. So I had to stop and think about that early shuffle. Yeah, Foyt was on the pole. Clark led the first lap. Foyt led the second lap. And then Clark took over from that point, and other than for the pit stop shuffle later on, effectively led the whole race. And after the race, when they were being interviewed, and Clark was asked about the battle with Foyt, and he said, and this sounded like real bravado, and out of a lot of people, you would have been booing and jeering, but Clark was so upfront with everything. He said, "No, I let him go by me because I just wanted to see what he had." Ooh. And then Foyt dropped out after 115 laps. I think it was with a transmission problem. And so it's a little bit different from what it is today. Clark and Foyt were the only two people that led the race. And Clark led 190 laps and Foyt led 10.
Wow. Thank you, Mike. More with Donald coming up on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We had a special guest tonight who contributed to our charities for the Carb Night Burger Bash last year. William Pran has been sitting with us and listening. And because you donated, you get to ask a question of Donald without waiting on hold, although you did have to drive here and wait for an hour and 50 minutes. But go ahead with your question for Donald.
All right. So, Donald, looking at the history of races, are there some really world famous drivers that came in back in the day who really came to win and were unable to do it, and maybe there's some neat stories?
Oh golly, I think everybody that came here came to win. And but as far as I mean, Nelson Piquet clearly in 1992, and I think we've talked about that maybe a couple of times on other nights, that he came back in 1993 and didn't really make any waves at all, and actually drove in the race. A lot of people forget that. They just remember that in 1992, he was getting quite a bit of notoriety and was very intense. And I think he was trying to win the pole, and then or at least he wasn't. He didn't make a qualifying run because he had the accident before we got to the first qualifying day. But I think that when he had the accident, I think it was in his mind, I mean, that he thought that he could win the pole because he had the Menard V8. But I think as far as the others, I don't know to really answer that because, again, I think any world-class driver came to win, although I think some were more interested in coming here than others. And we've had this situation in the mid-1960s, 66, 67, 68, well, especially those years when foreign drivers on tire contracts came here because they were contracted to come. And Jochen Rindt, for instance, was one that came here and didn't really want to be. He didn't want to be. And so that was pretty clear. Another one was Dennis Holm. And shows how things were different. Dennis Holm had come in the USAC office with George R. Bryant after the 1966 U.S. Grand Prix to beat the people at USAC, and supposedly he was going to drive at George Bryant the next year. So anyway, the weeks and months go by. We go through the winter, and then it comes out that Dennis Holm is entered for Smokey Unick. And so in May, when I found Dennis Holm, and I had talked with him a little bit during that visit, and I said, you know, what happened with the George Bryant car, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you're driving for Smokey Unick. I said, that really surprised me. What an assignment. Because I said, I can't believe the two of you had even heard of each other. He said, well, I hadn't heard of. And he said, what happened was, he said, I read about it. And this showed how different things were. He said, I read about it in Autosport, the British magazine, that said I was going to be driving at Indianapolis for Smokey Unick. And then he said, a day or two later, I got a telegram from Goodyear that said, you will be driving for Smokey Unick, report to garage, you know, 31 or whatever it is. And he said, I showed up and went in there and said, excuse me, is Smokey Unick in here? And a guy with a hat says, yeah, that's me. He said, oh, I'm Dennis Holm. I'm your driver. And I thought, golly, what happened to the days of going to the racetracks and you know, the drivers hounding the car owners and making deals at the White Front Bar down on 16th Street. But so I said, well, you know, how did it work out for you? He said, oh, he's a bloody good mechanic. And then they went ahead and finished fourth. So anyway, there's a lot of other stories about that. The ones that came that really were focused on it. And I think that certainly Fernando Alonso is not taking it lightly. He came because he wants to, and he's going to try and win.
It's going to be fun to watch, and it may be the first of several that we see him if he doesn't win this year. William, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for contributing to the charities for the Burger Bash. Always a pleasure, Donald.
Thank you, Kevin.
We will try again tomorrow night here at 8 o'clock, right after Trackside at 7 o'clock. Thanks to Charlene Birdsong, and back in our studios, Joey Molinaro. I'm Kevin Lee. Thank you so much for joining us here on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.